To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
And welcome to Labor Radio, bringing you news and views of by and for working people every Monday night at 6. I'm Al Bradbury.
And I'm Angela McQuinney. Tonight we'll be talking with author Sasha Lilly about her book, Capitalism and Its Discontents, and her activism as a shop steward at KPFA radio station.
Then we'll talk with Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue, about the history and limitations of alliances between police and labor.
We are here with Sasha Lilly, who is a KPFA broadcaster from Oakland, California, and the author of Capitalism and Its Discontents, Conversations with Radical Thinkers in a Time of Tumult. And this is a book put out by PM Press. Thank you for being with us, Sasha.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So these are definitely times of tumult. What sparked you initially to do these interviews right now and to put out this book?
Well, some of the interviews were done over the last several years in the course of my work at KPFA, since we look very critically at the capitalist system, trying to make sense of the forces that really shape our lives. But what, of course, has unfolded in the last several years has been what is perhaps the fourth global crisis of the capitalist system, the first being in the 1880s, then the 1930s, and then the 1970s, and now this. And so, you know, these are moments that are really, we're living through a time that's really reshaping the future. And I think that the kind of world that we'll live in is going to be determined by sort of who wins out in the struggle between, you know, taking the words from the title of my book, Capital, and the rest of us who are discontented.
So there are a mix of folks with different perspectives in this book, including Noam Chomsky, Tariq Ali, Mike Davis, among many others. What would you say are some of the uniting themes that struck you from doing a series of interviews with all of these thinkers?
Unifying themes?
Yeah.
Well, I think that one thing that unites all of those who I interviewed is that they take a kind of systemic approach at looking at the world that we live in, rather than one which is based on a sense of, you know, what reforms might mitigate the problem. Instead, they really are looking very deeply at the system itself. And so I would say that unifies people who I interviewed. And certain of the thinkers, in fact, some of the people who are less well-known, I think really stand out, such as a British socialist feminist, Ursula Hughes, who is one of the people who I interviewed, who really emphasizes a theme, which I think kind of runs throughout the book, about the fact that capitalism constantly tries to turn things into commodities, and that this is a constant process within capitalism, but it's really been accelerated over the past four decades over a period which is often described as a period of neoliberalism, and it has really included the enclosure of whatever was in the public sector or what might be called the commons. And I think in some ways what we're seeing now with the Occupy Wall Street protests is a real reaction against those forces of commodification and enclosure, and basically a kind of a claiming of public space and a demand for a real systemic change.
It seems that the events on November 3rd in Oakland do have a very strong message of systemic change, and that capitalism seems to be coming under very direct attack lately. Is that what you've seen being in Oakland and seeing how Occupy is evolving there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would hazard that the occupation in Oakland perhaps is one of the more radical ones in the country, and as you say, really situating itself in a critique of the system itself, and I think arising out of that kind of place. Not that, you know, of course, everyone who's involved in Occupy Oakland would share the same perspective, but I would say that more radical systemic critique is much more widespread within Occupy Oakland, and hence I don't think it was a huge leap for people to think about an action to take that would really be one about actually shutting down Capitol for a day, withholding people's labor, and kind of bringing all business as usual to a halt. And the action on Wednesday also, of course, harkened back to a moment in 1946, actually 3 days, when workers shut down Oakland in a general strike, which was the last citywide general strike in the U.S.
So one of the challenges you talk about and some of the authors talk about in the book is the difficulty in visioning and organizing towards post-capitalism. Do you see some hope in the Occupy movements and in things like the general strike in Oakland that that's changing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one thing that's really afflicted the left, and I use that term fairly broadly, over the past decades is that in many ways I think we've internalized the message that is most famously sort of summed up by Margaret Thatcher, Tina, there is no alternative to free market capitalism, we just have to take it. And so I think the left has really been afflicted by the fact that we really have stopped thinking about large-scale social transformation, that we've instead focused on piecemeal attempts to try and keep things from getting worse, maybe making things a little bit better. And I think that Occupy Wall Street and all the Occupies that have sprung out of it have actually really shifted that. I think it's still in process. I don't think it's complete. But the idea that we could actually think of transforming our societies in profound and large ways is starting to be somewhat on the table again, and I think that's absolutely crucial because I think that there's been, I think the left commonly despairs about why people won't join our movements, and yet when one looks at social movements and the history of social movements, one thing that really unites them, that is social movements that are sustained, is that they have some notion of hope, of kind of large-scale transformation and hope, and that has really been missing from the left, but I think that's now appearing with these very exciting movements.
One of the things that stood out for us in the events of November 3rd was that it seemed that organized labor was also starting to get more and more deeply involved in a more critical perspective on capitalism. Do you see a role for labor, and do some of the folks you interviewed see a role for worker organizing in changing where things are at and in addressing capitalism?
Yeah, I think, yes, absolutely. I think that unions are also seeing that if they don't shift their focus in some way and start addressing things on a larger scale, they're really doomed, given that union density is at the lowest it's been in 100 years. So it is good to see that unions are grasping this. I think that historians write that in the 1930s that the labor movement really had to reinvent itself during that major economic crisis. And I think that the labor movement now is really in the same boat that hopefully it will. I mean, there's nothing preordained, I guess, about it. But it's a chance for that to happen. And yes, the contributors to my book do think that labor is a crucial facet in any kind of transformation of society. But it also, I think most of them would agree that unions themselves need to be reshaped and that that they need to remake themselves with the rank and file having a direct role in the direction of union movements. And that, you know, in some way that also prefigures what a post-capitalist society could, in fact, look like, that those sort of stratifications and hierarchies that can in many ways afflict the union movement now, in the course of struggle, hopefully could be transformed because a better society certainly would not be one which is, you know, afflicted with bureaucracy.
So I want to turn just for a little bit and talk about your role as a labor activist and as a shop steward at KPFA. And It's one of the things that always surprises me when we talk about progressive institutions that take an anti-union or anti-worker stance or move in that direction. Would you share a little bit about your experience as a worker at KPFA and some of the challenges that you and your coworkers have been facing?
Sure. Well, so I should say KPFA is the first listener-sponsored radio station in the U.S. It was founded more than 60 years ago by anarchists in the Bay Area who were war resistors. And it has had a long history of reporting and covering worker struggles and conflicts. So, of course, it's really depressing when a place like that has, that the management at a place like that then takes on these sort of anti-worker policies. But not entirely surprising. I think that's fairly common within a lot of nonprofits. But in the case of KPFA, last year we had the most popular program on the air was removed and its workers were fired in violation of our union contract. One of them was later restored because I guess management realized that they were not would not win in arbitration. But since then, we've had a campaign by management, I think, to break our union. They've hired a $400 an hour law firm to take on our union. They have compared our manager has compared us people in the union to a fifth column, which is a fascist term. It has been very hostile and very unpleasant. And we recently found out that the parent organization of KPFA, which is Pacifica, has just been raiding our pensions at union workers' pensions. They're claiming that they essentially were just borrowing money and they paid us back. But that's a violation of the law. It's not up to management to decide what to do with the pensions of its workers. So it has been a very rough time at the station. And, of course, for all radio stations in an economic crisis, there are money troubles. But what has been going on at Pacifica has been really ugly, and I would say really politically driven. So we continue to fight, and but it is definitely a difficult situation.
Are there ways that people who feel strongly about supporting workers and supporting particularly workers who deliver such a community service with community radio could support you and your coworkers?
Well, there's a website. It's kpfaworker.org, where people can go and they can find out more about what's been going on. They can sign up for alerts. We have had people in the area, of course, come out. There have been pickets at the station, and the labor union movement has come out for us. But people who are further flung can also help by contacting management and saying that they don't appreciate this going on. But I do think a larger awareness about these kind of dynamics within nonprofits or progressive institutions is just really important, because I think often people can just not be aware that the same sort of dynamics that play out in other environments which might be profit-driven, clearly nonprofits aren't driven by that motive, but a lot of the same anti-worker and anti-union sentiment can be seen.
Would you share the supporter website one more time with us?
Oh, sure. It's kpfaworker.org.
Wonderful. And if folks are interested in getting a copy of your book, Capitalism and Its Discontents, how would they get a copy of your book?
They can go to pmpress.org, PM, like the better half of the day, pmpress.org, and they can find it there.
All right. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us, Sasha.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
We're talking with Christian Williams, the author of the book Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and the recent article Cops for Labor? In the September-October issue of Dollars and Cents magazine. He's also a member of UAW 1981, the National Writers Union. Christian, welcome to Labor Radio.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So in your Dollars and Cents article, you start from the surprising alliance of police taking the side of labor in the massive popular uprisings in Wisconsin against Governor Walker's union-busting legislation earlier this year. And you investigate the history of police solidarity with workers and find that Wisconsin 2011 wasn't the first time, although you call these incidents the exception rather than the rule. Can you share a few other historical examples?
Sure. Well, again, I will probably start and end by noting that these are exceptional. Ordinarily, the role of police in labor conflict is to suppress the efforts of the workers. But yet there have been these historical cases. Probably the most famous is the role of police chief Sid Hadfield in the coal strike in Matuan, West Virginia. Of course, it's most famous because of the John Sayles movie. And Hadfield enforced the law in ways that favored the union against the detective company goons hired by the mine owners. Ultimately, that cost him his life. And as I was looking through the historical record, it turned out that that was a particularly dramatic case, but there were other cases of police either refusing to intervene against strikers or in some cases intervening in strikes to defend strikers against scabs or against Pinkertons. So, for example, in a streetcar strike in Richmond, Virginia, the police simply refused to intervene against the striking workers. In nearby Henrico, the sheriff took the additional step of taking legal action against the I think there were Pinkertons in that case, but in any case, the private security guards.
In your book, Our Enemies in Blue, and also as an activist in Portland, you've studied the police closely. The rhetoric of the current Occupy movement describes the U.S. as economically divided between the 99% and the 1%, and some in the movement have called for alliances with the police on the grounds that they, too, are part of the 1%. Is there any truth to this? Would you describe the police as part of the working class?
Well, it's a complicated question. I mean, in some respects, yes, because cops tend to be of sort of working class background, and they do suffer the irritations of wage labor. That said, their job overall is largely the control of the rest of the working class. And so their role is more managerial than it is sort of labor, right? So, even though they may not directly, they may not have a supervisory role within the police institution. The role of that institution is to supervise the workers. So it's kind of like the manager of Burger King is also badly paid and doesn't enjoy the benefits of the full value of his labor, et cetera, et cetera. But his job is to make sure that everybody else at Burger King, keeps flipping the burgers and whatever. So there's a sense in which he is drawn from the working class, but there's also a sense in which he's representing the interests and also the power of the owners. The police are in kind of an equivalent position in terms of society as a whole. So I'm personally kind of ambivalent about the argument that they're part of the 99%. I think to the degree that the cops identify with the workers, it's good. I think to the degree that the workers identify with the cops, it's bad. Because the police have an enormous amount of discretion, and that sympathy may make some difference as to how they handle unrest. On the other hand, if the workers over-identify with the police, they're really going to end up confused about who their friends and who their enemies are.
In your Dollars and Cents article, you argue, sort of contrary to what one might expect, that since the 1930s, the legalization of unions and the formation of police unions actually has decreased the instances of solidarity between police and labor. Can you explain that?
Sure. It is a little bit counterintuitive, but the phenomenon to be explained here is that those exceptional cases that I described were mostly entirely in the late 19th and early 20th century. And in the period since the 1940s, they've dropped off precipitously. One reason for that is that the labor movement as a whole has become institutionalized in a way that has largely relocated the conflict between unions and bosses out of the factories and out of the streets and into courtrooms of various kinds. And so there's just less conflict in labor conflict, so that the police are less often facing the dilemma of their personal sympathies conflicting with their jobs. On the other hand, there's also, during that time, police have also become unionized. And they've done so in a way which was deliberately set up to remove them from contact with the rest of the labor movement. And that's been very successful. And it's also had the effect of increasing vertical solidarity between the cops on the street and their commanders, such that the role of the police union is not really equivalent to the role of other trade unions, and instead it becomes the representative body for the institution as a whole. So police unions don't so much organize cops as workers, they organize cops as cops. And that has both increased the distance between the cops and their counterparts in other unions, but has also maintained a level of unity top to bottom in the institution.
Can you give an example of what you mean by that? Organizing cops as opposed to cops as workers?
Sure. The agenda of police unions is, in general, what you might call right-wing. It's suspicious of social change. It's intolerant of disorder. It is quick to justify the use of force and that sort of thing. And the implications of that agenda for the rest of the working class tend to be bad. At the same time, part of that agenda is also insulating not just the sort of line officers, but the institution as a whole from other kinds of accountability or from public scrutiny, and defending the operation of the police institution from pressures that it may receive either from the public or from the elected parts of the government. And so the agenda that police unions follow tends to track the interests of the institution as a whole, including their commanders, rather than the interests of the class that they are ambivalently part of.
So, for instance, insulating them from accountability for unjustified violence?
Sure. I mean, really all kinds of accountability, but that's probably the element that has the greatest implications for working people.
You've also written about the private policing arrangement here in Portland, where the Portland Business Alliance employs officers to patrol downtown in coordination with the city police, the so-called Clean and Safe program. Do you think it makes a difference in cops' behavior towards labor or working people more generally when their employer is a private business organization rather than the government?
Well, it certainly makes it clear what side their bread's buttered on. I haven't seen empirical data about whether they handle that specifically differently. Historically, my guess is that it probably makes relatively little difference. I mean, in the early part of the 20th century, in Pennsylvania, local cops proved to be very unreliable in handling strikes, largely because they had social and familial ties with the people that they were supposed to be crushing. To handle that, the coal and iron companies formed a private police force called the Coal and Iron Police, which was brutal and very effective in terms of breaking the strikes, but also kind of disreputable. And in part to handle the kinds of scandals that the Coal and Iron Police created, but also in part because to relieve the companies of the need to pay for these services, the Pennsylvania state government took over the job of the Coal and Iron Police and created the first statewide police department, the Pennsylvania State Constabulary. The public police did not have any better of a record in terms of their treatment of the labor movement than the private police had. So I don't think it's simply reductive as far as who signs the paychecks. What I think is more dangerous is that to the degree that they are answerable to a private company, they're also explicitly not accountable to any kind of public organization. And so there's another level of insulation between the cops and any sort of public pressure, any sort of public scrutiny. And I suspect that that's very much the point.
Yes. Yeah, so I was interested in your perspective on the fairly excessive use of force that started to pop up in response to Occupy in other parts of the country. Specifically in Oakland, California, there are people who have been put into critical condition in the hospital using tear gas and flashbang canisters, as well as police beating protesters. So what are some of the things that people should be aware of and be conscious of as they try to prepare themselves for future interactions with the police that may continue to escalate?
I think the main thing is that violence is predictable. I mean, the cops are in the job of hurting people. And so, they have different strategies as far as how they contain crowds. And their preferred way is to channel resistance into avenues that are not disruptive and don't present a challenge and are easily contained or co-opted. But when that fails, their second tool is to use violence. And I think to the degree that any social movement wants to be effective, it needs to avoid the dangers of co-optation and containment, which means it needs to be prepared to face that violence. And how exactly it does that is probably going to depend on the politics of the movement and also the conditions under which it's operating, and therefore what strategy is going to be the best.
We've been talking to Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue. You can find links to his recent writings at his website, christianwilliams.com. That's Christian with a K.
You've been listening to KBOO Labor Radio. Thank you to our engineer, AJ, and tune in next week for your friendly neighborhood letter carrier, Kevin Card. Now stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.